This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, in for Terry Gross. Emily Colas lived in a dangerous world. She believed that if she ate out at a restaurant, she would be poisoned. She checked her children's clothes for bloodstains every day. She frantically inspected packaged foods for tears and tampering. Emily Colas had obsessive-compulsive disorder, a condition marked by repetitive, irrational thoughts and behaviors that would take over her life. And though her mind terrorized her and drove her into tedious rituals, Colas's frank new memoir, which is called Just Checking, is actually quite funny. She wrote the book after going into therapy and going on Prozac, which has enabled her to get her fears and compulsions under control. Emily Colas is now a single mother of two living in Ann Arbor, Michigan. She told me that many of her fears were about germs, food, and cleanliness.
Yeah, it was really about, finally about catching a disease. And so it was a matter of worrying that there was blood somewhere or that a person might have a cut. If somebody walked by me on the street and then I happened to notice that they were, like, wiping their nose, then I'd think that they clearly had a bloody nose. And so my husband and I would be chasing them down the street to check, to make sure that, you know, that wasn't the case. So it became, you know, just any sorts of way that I can imagine a disease getting into my life. So whether it was some spot on the ground that I assumed was blood or a hypodermic needle on a chair that I might sit on or something like that.
And the fear was that what was sitting there was going to get you.
Exactly.
When you get sick, or perhaps even when you were in the throes of all this and you got sick, did you have some dramatic explanations about what was wrong with you? Did you think you were going to die if you had a common cold, for instance?
Yeah, it was less about dying. I mean, that would have been a relief.
Yeah.
It's that sort of process of dying that, you know, you have a cough and it's clearly TB or, you know, things like that. And I think what you're then able to do is, like, look at all the literature on TB. I mean, I became an expert at all sorts of diseases. And so you think about the incubation period or where you could have come in contact with it or what the symptoms are and, you know, how you'd know if you had this particular disease. And so I'd spend my time thinking about stuff like that.
You write about your parents, and you talk about your father as a kind of control person. That seemed to be important to him. Yes?
Yeah, probably. I think. Which part are you referring to? And the he had his breakfast thing, where he, you know, everything was sort of ordered.
He had the same breakfast every morning.
And ate it the same way every day. And I would just sort of be transfixed watching him eating his breakfast. But yeah, I think everything had a routine and an order and a structure.
You also describe being put to bed by your mother, who would stand at the doorway and flick the light switch several times. Describe that scene for us.
She would, she didn't actually explain it to me until, like, 5 or 6 years ago, what she was actually doing, but she would put me to bed and she'd go to turn the light off and she would just be sitting there flicking the switch just for a very long time. And I just thought she didn't think it was off, but in fact, she had to flick it in multiples of four until she described it as until it felt right. So she would just be sitting there flicking it over and over again.
And as a little girl in bed, what did you think was going on?
I wasn't really sure. I didn't know. She was always a somewhat sort of ordered person as well and very neat. And I think there was that sense where I just thought she didn't think it was off. And so she was just sort of checking it to make sure it was off. I didn't realize there was that whole sort of uneasiness in her body and that need for the sort of repetition to kind of calm it.
I want to have you read a section from the book, and this is a kind of a ritual that you developed to help you to go to sleep, but it began with a fear, and it's called counting sheep.
Do you ever feel like your tongue is too big for your mouth? I was lying in bed trying to fall asleep when I started to think my tongue didn't quite fit anymore. Once I started focusing on this, it was all I could think about. I imagined my tongue was expanding in its already close quarters. My body started to tingle. I had trouble breathing, and I began to wonder if a swollen tongue would obstruct breathing through my nose as well. I tried to distract myself by thinking about small things while taking deep breaths. I toyed with the idea of calling my doctor, but felt that familiar pang of embarrassment. What would I say? Since it was so late and his office was closed, I'd have to call his service, give my name, and when the operator asked me what's wrong, say, "I think my tongue is swelling." She might just laugh and hang up the phone, or maybe this really happens and she'd send an ambulance over immediately. I wasn't thrilled with either option. After a few hours of going over my choices, I came to the realization that if my tongue was indeed growing, it was a pretty slow process, and I fell asleep.
And that's Emily Colas reading from her book called Just Checking, Scenes from the Life of an Obsessive Compulsive. When you have a thought like that, and I think many people get irrational thoughts, most people can dismiss them and just say, oh, that's crazy. You didn't have a voice in your head that could dismiss that and say, of course my tongue isn't swelling.
Well, I think that's exactly it. I mean, and that's what I hope, you know, appeals to people. It's that it's a worry, just like anybody has a worry. And somehow you or someone else is able to just make it go away. And I can't do that. And in addition to not being able to do that, I just, you know, get the sort of worries or thoughts just get weirder and weirder. So, you know, you're all of a sudden imagining ground up hypodermic needles in your food. But there's a really normal process from, you know, the start of the worry to that point.
Were you constantly talking yourself into this stuff, out of this stuff?
Constantly. It's sort of all you do. You have these two voices. Well, I probably have more than two voices, but these two were the sort of irrational, you know, going over the worry and thinking about it and spinning on it. And for me, it was sort of thinking of ways in which it probably was safe and that I didn't need to worry. And then there's that sort of rational voice saying, this is insane. Stop thinking about this. You're a nut. Just let it go. So the two of them are sort of constantly fighting. And I think, you know, it's one of the most frustrating parts of this is that you just want to be utterly and totally insane so that you don't know you're spending so much time being a nut. But, the two of them just sort of fight with each other in a way.
In fact, you call it insanity light, that it's not full-blown psychosis or something like that, because there still is this little rational self left.
Right. I mean, I talk about at some point in the book fearing that my food is poisoned, and somebody at one of the readings once said to me, well, that sounds like paranoid schizophrenic. So, I mean, I think some of the parts of the book, you read it and you think, yeah, that's full-on insanity. But I think for the most part, it's, you know, sometimes people say, well, it's just neurotic. So it's almost like neurotic times 1,000. And it doesn't feel like you can say, yeah, this is full on insanity. So sort of the worst of all the worlds.
Yeah.
You know, you're constantly consumed by this and you don't even get to be called crazy. It just seems unfair.
Well, did it seem like it would be easier to be called crazy then you wouldn't have to at least fight with yourself about this stuff?
Right, totally. Yeah, there's something, I don't know, something comforting about the fact that someone says, you're a nut job and that's it. But this one, it was sort of like, I know what I'm doing is nutty, so.
Well, you have a funny scene. It's also a very poignant scene when you're first dating your husband and he invites you over to dinner to make a lovely meal for you. And you're sitting there while he's preparing the meal and you're thinking, what? You're thinking he's trying to lace your food with poison.
Yeah, that one, can I give the pre-story to that
as
well?
Yes, please.
Because it's not, I was at a party, and this boy was just sitting at a table, and he was eating the sugar cubes out of the bowl that's sitting on the table. And the hostess said to him, oh my God, don't eat that, it's where we put our acid. And this guy gets this horrified look on his face, because by that point he's had like 10 hits of acid. And she starts joking and laughing, and so all of a sudden, this, you know, I'm like witness to this, and I think, okay, yeah, so that could happen. You know, there's food, nobody's watching it, no one's, you know, tending to it, and it could totally be laced. So then I started to think that, you know, I couldn't necessarily trust what was going to be in my food. So then I personally stopped going to restaurants and all of that and ate prepackaged food, but I couldn't say this to this guy on the second date. So he said, I want to make you dinner, and I thought, okay, fine. And so I was afraid that perhaps he was going to poison my food. And so there became this whole sort of fear about whether or not he did that. He brought the food out. And then he sort of disappeared for a minute. And I thought, well, maybe I should just switch the plates. And then I, you know, sort of went through the whole, you know, if I switched the plates and it was laced, then he'd die. And then the police would come and question me and I'd get in trouble for having, you know, poisoned him. And I didn't even do it. And then, you know, if... So anyway, so eventually he came back and I didn't switch the plates because I thought it was really important to start the relationship on the right foot and trust him. And so I did. And, you know, I sort of waited around after I ate for the drugs to take effect. And when they didn't,
you're okay.
I thought, this guy's a keeper.
Your life is exhausting.
I know.
To read about it. I mean, here you are having this very innocent, innocuous meal with this guy who eventually does marry you, and you've got this whole paranoid fantasy going on.
Yeah, but I mean, it's funny because as you're saying that, I'm thinking also, it's probably tiring for people on the second date to try and, you know, sort of meet a guy and talk about their lives and all of that. So instead of dealing with that sort of intimacy, I sort of spun off on the worries. So in a way, it's probably as tiring as a second date, but that was probably too daunting for me. So it was easier to just, you know, spin on something I was comfortable with, which is, you know, poison and things like that.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And our guest today is Emily Colas, and we're talking about her memoir. It's called Just Checking, Scenes from the Life of an Obsessive Compulsive. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air. My guest is Emily Colas, and we're talking about her book called Just Checking, Scenes from the Life of an Obsessive Compulsive. What I find interesting is that even though you had all these fears, you got pregnant. You got pregnant twice. And I think for many expectant mothers and fathers, too, there are a lot of hopes and expectations, but there are a lot of natural fears associated with pregnancy. But you did it anyway.
Well, I think, I mean, it's like I said before, I think there was that sense of not being certain what to do with myself or what to do with my mind or how to spend all this sort of energy. And there were all these attempts to solve it. And I think the desire to get married and to have children was, you know, the attempt to have a purpose or a role. So that it's not that I thought, okay, I'm so worried, and if I get pregnant, the hormones will surge, and I'll be worried about the fetus, and it'll just be out of control. It was more like, this will distract me. So.
And to do something, quote-unquote, normal, get married and have children, that's what regular people do.
Yeah, then I'm a mother, and I'm normal, and I'll be paying so much attention to being a wife and mother that I won't have time to do these silly, worrying things anymore. But I was wrong.
Well, to the point where when your first baby was born, you became convinced it wasn't yours.
Well, yeah. I mean, she came home. She's so darling. She came home and she was so quiet and she slept all the time and she was just sweet and she never cried. And I thought, there's no way this could be my kid. My kid's going to be like a moody, whiny, complaining bitch. So I, you know, I thought, well, you know, maybe it's not mine. And then it occurred to me that When you're leaving the hospital, you're supposed to match up your wristband with the baby's ankle band and check that the numbers are the same and sign something. And I just had a baby, so I was tired and I was out of it. And I assumed that my husband, since he was the official checker anyway, right, was doing this. But it turns out he wasn't. And so then I, you know, I had my wristband or hers. I can't remember whose I had, but I only had one. So I started checking photos from the hospital to see if any of them were visible. And then thought about blood tests and DNA tests and all of that because there was no sort of way to determine whether or not she was truly mine.
So what finally convinced you?
She's listening, right? I'm still not sure. Well, I mean, aside from the fact that she looked a lot like us,
right,
there were things like I got teeth at 6 months. I had like 8 teeth at 6 months, and that's unusual. And she had that as well. And I would go to the doctor and I'd say, we look alike, don't we? And he'd say, yes. And we sort of grew at the same rate. So, I mean, it was those kinds of things that, you know, aside from, you know, and the fact that she looks exactly like me, made me sort of get comfortable with it. But, I mean, it's like, I think I knew she was mine. I mean, there were other things that happened. Like, she was forceps baby, so she had these little marks under her eyes, and she had lots of hair. So it was clear, you know, we recognized her. So it wasn't like, you know, some generic baby. So I think it was, you know, I knew that she was really mine, and because I somewhere fundamentally knew that, it allowed me to sort of go wild with the other stuff. And then I guess when I got tired of that worry, I moved on.
Is that what happens too with some worries, that you just exhaust yourself on them, or they're not as interesting or as provocative as they once were?
Oh, yeah, I think absolutely. You know, how many, well, with the baby not being your own, there are lots of different ways in which you can sort of explore that. And then you go through them all and you think, okay, now I'm bored. And you think of something new that you can go off on. So, yeah, I think that's exactly what happens.
What got you to the point then of thinking, this is ridiculous? I can't go on with my life like this.
Oh, yeah, the this is ridiculous happened long before the I can't go on with my life. But, you know, at that point, after I'd had my second kid and my husband and I both thought that, you know, because I had the two in a row, I thought, well, once this isn't, you know, the case anymore and I'm not responsible for this fetus, then I'll get better. And he thought that as well. And I didn't. Mm-hmm. And so I started to sort of lie to him about it. So I would still be worried but wouldn't share this stuff with him anymore. And there came this point where we were watching television, and I sort of absentmindedly went to turn the volume up. And when I looked at the screen, I noticed that someone on TV had been in a fight and was spitting blood into the snow. And I became convinced that I had contracted a disease from this Wow. encounter. And so much so that I couldn't keep it to myself, and I told him about it. And he was, at first, he like sort of went back into that role. Of, you know, sort of placating me with, you know, that was taped months ago and any diseases in that blood would be dead and there was a screen in front of, you know, and he's sort of going on and then all of a sudden he's like, whoa, wait a minute, this is just way too nuts. And at that point he, you know, he said, we need to do something about this. And in part, I think there was that going on, and then ultimately we separated. He just couldn't take it anymore and he left. And those sort of two things combined sent me into this really horrible depression because I couldn't function without him. And it got to the point where I thought, you know, you're just out of your mind. This is ridiculous. And your life looks this way that you just didn't imagine it was going to look. And that kind of finally gave me the courage to try the medicine that I was so afraid to take.
Yeah, and you talk about taking that first pill. First of all, what kind of medicine did they prescribe for you?
For me, it was Prozac.
And you were afraid to take it?
Right, because at the time, I mean, maybe it was leading up to this as well, but at the time there were stories in the news about people who had taken Prozac and got on these, like, shooting sprees, and they would say, well, it was the Prozac. And I just thought, great, I'll be, like, a crazy medicated killer, and that's going to, like, suck more than just being crazy. So I was afraid to take it. I mean, there were other side effects, too. They, you know, could have convulsions or things like that, and I just thought it was too daunting. And then it got to the point where I thought, I don't care.
Right.
And so
right.
I took it.
And how did it work on you? I mean, this stuff takes a little time to work into your system.
Right. I think it probably took about 4 to 6 weeks before it did what it needed to do. But what it did in the meantime was made me very tired and kind of numbed my brain, which was perfect. I mean, I slept all the time and I was like dopey in a way, and it was nice. It sort of quieted my mind in a way that I, you know, I was really happy to have it do. And then over time, I realized that the worries were kind of, they were still there, just like, you know, anybody would have a worry, but they weren't gripping. And I would try and run with them, and I couldn't.
Huh.
So.
Was there relief in that? But at the same time, you were so used to building your life around all these worries and fears.
Well, yeah, that was sort of the strange part of it. It's like, it's so nice to have that miserable part gone, but there was also a fun part of it as well. I mean, it gave me a lot of stories to tell, and it filled up my brain in a way that I really enjoyed. I mean, I had these really intricate, complicated disease transition models in my head, and all of a sudden they became sort of useless. And so it was like a lot of brain space and I wasn't certain what to do with it, so... Yeah, it was bittersweet.
Well, did life seem kind of dull now that you weren't worried about people putting hypodermic needles in your meals?
That's right. Where are they? It was absolutely, it was totally dull. I mean, I would still think about it. I'd think, okay, this is boring. I need to spice up this meal by thinking of some sort of toxin in it. And it just wouldn't click, and I couldn't. And so I thought, well, what am I going to do with myself? And so at that point, because I had gone on medication, my husband came back. And so we were sort of trying to work on the relationship, and I was trying to figure out what to do with myself and what kind of job I was going to get. And it was all horribly boring and tiresome.
And not kind of what your life used to be in the past.
Right, exactly. And I was sort of like not sure what to do with myself.
Now, how about today? Are you still taking medication?
I'm not. I stopped a few months ago.
Was that scary to go off?
Well, I was always sort of a self-medicator. You know, when I would get worse, I would take more. And when I was feeling better, I would take less. And there were times when I did actually stop and the worries came back really quickly. And this time I went off and they didn't. So I sort of knew what to, I knew that if I stopped, they might come back. And I was sort of, you know, trying to keep it in check, as it were. And so far it's been okay, but, you know, I keep that bottle
right.
So in my medicine chest just in case.
So you monitor your thoughts kind of like, how am I doing today? And do you have someone you can check it out with just to make sure you're not losing
someone it? Like,
I don't know, a
like
friend?
A professional, a friend. Yeah, well, that's the sort of tricky thing, because that's what, you know, the role I'd put my husband in, and that wasn't particularly useful because there's that sense of wanting to be kind of loving and supportive without being enabling. And so, I try, though not particularly successfully, to keep my friends out of it. But, I guess I sort of do that. And I mean, to this day, the thoughts come into my head. They're just not gripping. So, if something starts to grip me, then I think, okay, can I stop this? Or, you know, is it happening again?
Well, I want to thank you very much, Emily Colas, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Emily Colas's memoir is called Just Checking. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.